In this panel, we're going to be discussing some developments in hedge fund fee structures and, time permitting, some other structural developments. Let me first introduce our panelists. Starting at my far left, we have Alexander Mumji. Alex is a managing principal and head of Park Hill's hedge fund origination and project management team. Alex joined Park Hill, which is now a Blackstone affiliate, with over 17 years of experience in the alternative asset and investment space. Prior to Park Hill, he held managing director positions at Credit Suisse and First Boston. Stuart LeBlanc, you've already met. He is co-head of Akin Gump's tax department and also serves as the wartime consigliere for several of our hedge fund clients. To my immediate left is Bruce Simonetti. Bruce is also a partner in our tax department and heads our executive compensation and employee benefits practice. Before we start talking about some of the more technical and specific issues, Alex, let me start with you. Maybe you can give us some market color on who is actually raising money in the current market environment.
Yeah, well, it's a certainly different landscape than it was a year ago or so. A couple things to look at when you consider investor demand nowadays that we're seeing anyway. What investors are very much focused on is, themselves. They've seen the enemy and its other investors. They're concerned about what impact other investors may have through redemptions in compromising the manager's ability to pursue the strategy that they're involved with. So what they're doing is two things. One, they're focusing on highly liquid strategies, strategies where the underlying exposures are very liquid, and as a result, the funds have liquid terms. And on the other side, they're looking, in the case of, say, strategies that are focused on dislocations in the credit markets or distress, they're looking for fund structures which really help ensure a stable capital base through hybrid structures, which are more, have very much private equity types of components associated with them, long lockups or investment periods with the ability to reinvest and then distributions thereafter, or perhaps even investor gates, as opposed to fund gates, which were very much in vogue before the excitement we've had over the past year or so. Investors are looking for investor gates, which you would think that, you know, fund managers would be looking for, but now investors are looking for that because they don't want, again, capital to be flying out of the funds and therefore impacting their own value of their interest. So what we see here is a bifurcation across the liquidity spectrum. We see investors very much interested in, as I said, highly liquid strategies. That would be strategies such as global macro, actively traded long-short credit, tactical strategies, commodities, that sort of thing, where you could have quarterly, even, believe it or not, monthly liquidity. We see, you know, world-class institutional investors, sovereign wealth funds, corporate pension funds, looking for even monthly liquidity because that's all that's required for that strategy, given the underlying exposures being so liquid. At the other end of the spectrum, they're happy to go to these quasi-private equity structures. And it's the funds that are in the middle that, you know, have a mismatch between fund liquidity and the underlying exposures, or may have a one-year lockup and quarterly that are really not raising capital in today's markets.
Are you seeing any appetite on the part of investors to opt for longer lockups in exchange for reduced fees?
Yeah, there's some of that. I mean, where you see, the reduced fees, they tend to come in situations where you have big size involved. Let's face it, it's all, you know, it's a negotiation. Who has a negotiation strength? So, if you have a well-established fund, in order to get reduced fees, you're going to have to give big size. And, you know, if it's a $1.5 billion, $2 billion fund, it's got to be an order of $200, $250 million or so. That's what we've seen anyway in the mandates that we're involved with. Other situations where you could have reduced fees, of course, are new funds. Funds that need to bring in, hopefully, a cornerstone investor, or an investor with some cachet in the marketplace, and they're happy to, managers are often, in those situations, happy to give reduced fees, or maybe it's a participation in the gross fees of the manager. And the third situation, which we don't see much of, to be honest, is long lockups. You know, you may have a fund that has quarterly liquidity. They may consider giving a fee break to investors who are willing to give a 3 or 5 year lockup. You do see those very occasionally because, in the end, I think the liquidity of the underlying exposures is what rules as to how long an investor is willing to lock up. But there are some pension funds that are willing to do that sort of thing. But typically where we see this take place, reduced fees, is when somebody really steps up in size early in the process when the manager is ready to get that capital raising momentum.
Yeah, that's certainly consistent with what we've seen, namely that longer lockups are really being driven by the strategy much more than by fee breaks or other factors. Let's turn to some of the issues associated with longer lockups and fee terms associated with longer lockups. We saw earlier in the year manifestos from CalPERS and from Utah insisting on a better correlation between the lockup terms and the compensation terms of the managers. And in particular, we've seen Utah and other institutional investors being very aggressive in their insistence that if a manager wants a longer lockup, the manager needs to have the performance compensation in some sense correlated with the duration of the lockup. Stuart, do you want to talk about some of the structures and some of the issues that they pose?
Sure. So this focus on a multi-year performance shouldn't create so many problems. It's basically exists in almost all private equity funds, either through a clawback mechanism or a subordinated carry. In the hedge fund world, as the state pension funds seem to be clamoring for these multi-year, or at least suggesting that they will require these multi-year performance periods, the tax issues seem to arise in the hedge fund context because people don't like the result that occurred in the private equity world. Because of 457 Cap A and the inability to defer management fees, the natural solution to a multi-year performance period in a hedge fund would be to take the compensation as a carried interest, which would preserve character if there was capital gain, but requires the manager to pay tax on its share of realized income, even though it doesn't have an economic entitlement to any share of any compensation until the end of the performance period, like a subordinated carry in a private equity fund. I think managers would be happy to simply receive a distribution from the fund to pay their taxes, just like in the private equity world. For some interesting phenomenon, I think because of a particular promoter called Op Capital, which we'll talk about in a little bit, who's promoting an option strategy, and also because of the pension funds focusing on this issue, there seems to be a rejection by the pension fund class of that concept of paying out the tax distribution on the theory that it basically reduces their clawback right or the alignment between the manager and the pension fund. If a tax distribution is made, that's less money to claw back to the pension fund if the manager ultimately doesn't perform well in subsequent years if he was performing or she was performing well in earlier years. So you end up, I think anyone who's dealing with a hedge fund in this room has probably kind of felt this debate. I'd like to ask, has anybody actually invested in these multi-year classes for pension funds, or is this being dangled in front of funds as to promote somebody else's shelter strategy? What's really going on here? Because basically almost everybody in this room has been approached on behalf of the pension fund or on behalf of the promoter. with an alternative to a carry structure.
I'm sorry, I lost you a little
I'm
bit
sorry.
There. So you
I gave a convoluted question. For example, Utah and,
right.
and CalPERS, who have been, have they been successful in convincing managers
to take longer lockup capital
yes.
with some sort of reduced fee structure associated with that,
or a fee structure that is measured over a longer period of time, and to be willing to either pay a tax distribution or convince the manager to take an alternative path.
Yeah, you know, we haven't seen it. Now, granted, we only get involved with 8 to 10 mandates a year, but you know, they are typically capital coming in from the largest institutional investors, including the public pension funds, and again. You know, I think managers are very concerned about most favored nations issues. And if they let, Utah come in for a certain amount of money, with a special structure, they got to be willing to provide that to all the other investors. And it becomes a slippery slope when you get involved in side letters or special deals like that. And to the extent a manager is able to attract a significant amount of capital without doing that, they aren't. I know there's been a lot of high-profile talk and a lot of the hedge fund conferences about these structures and these ideas, but we at our firm we're just not seeing much of it.
So there's two basic approaches. One is the carried interest, where the investor is willing to pay a tax distribution, which reduces the clawback potential. The other is for the manager just to pay tax on an annual fee basis, with a clawback right, where they pay tax today out of their own pocket and then owe money back to the pension fund if subsequent performance is bad. So what these promoters are really prominent in advancing is an option arrangement, and I'll let Bruce describe it, that potentially would get around some of these issues from a tax perspective and allow for, taken to their extreme, significant tax deferral and compounding that's very similar to the tax deferral that was shut down last year by legislation.
Right. Before I get into describing the option program that's being promoted by Op Capital and some significant state pension funds, I think it's important just to understand what the tax issue is under 457A as it relates to a multi-year performance period. In general, 457A provides that a taxpayer is subject to income tax in the year in which his compensation is no longer subject to a substantial risk of forfeiture. And for a typical fund manager's incentive fees, there is no substantial risk of forfeiture within the meaning of 457A that would typically apply, because 457A conveniently provides that it's a service condition, it's not a performance condition. So even though we're talking about a performance fee that you might not earn anything over a three-year period, for example, In any rational way, you haven't earned anything until the end of that three-year period, but not for 457A purposes, you're vested effectively day one. So what 457A says is, since you don't know what that amount is, well, you don't have to pay tax currently. You can wait until the end of that three-year period. You can tack on an extra 20% tax and take on an interest charge from the day of vesting all the way back to the day you first vested in it. So needless to say, that's not a solution that appeals to many folks. So one way to address this, aside from setting up and going with a clawback arrangement, or what one of the solutions that we're talking about is an option strategy. And what does that really mean? Well, rather than taking a typical 20% incentive fee on an annual basis, or forgetting 457A for a second, taking a 20% incentive fee over a three-year period, the manager doesn't get an incentive fee at all. Effectively, what the manager would receive is an option to acquire 20% of the upside on the fund itself. From a statutory standpoint, 457A defines non-qualified deferred compensation similar to 409A of the code, which I think a lot of folks dealing with deferred compensation are familiar with over the last several years. And 409A of the Internal Revenue Code provides that if you grant fair market value stock options to a service provider, it doesn't result in deferred compensation. It's effectively exempt from the rules. So 457A dovetails off that and suggests that if you receive a stock option from a corporation, or you arguably could do it in a partnership, or a stock appreciation right that's settled in stock, that is not deferred compensation for 457A purposes. So you could design an option, in theory, that could provide that it's not exercisable for a period of time. If you had an investor that's insisting on a 3-year performance period, the option wouldn't be exercisable for 3 years. In that way, it effectively mirrors the economics of what your investor would want. In general, stock options aren't taxable on grant. It's only taxable on exercise. So if this program works, it certainly would achieve the business objectives that you might otherwise agree to with an investor, which is to establish the multi-year performance period. But it goes on from there, because you don't need to provide that the stock option necessarily must be exercised at the end of that 3-year period. Stock options aren't taxable, for the most part, until you exercise them. So effectively, they do have a built-in deferral component to them. So if you have a 20-year stock option, for example, you can keep on compounding your earnings. And in many ways, the stock option starts to look a lot like your old deferred compensation with one really material difference. Under the old system, you were basically annualizing a fee. Typically, you were investing it back in the fund. If the fund went up or down, you made money, you lost money, only a proportionate piece. So if the fund goes up $100 in a year, you earn 20. It goes down, and you deferred that 20. It goes down 50% the next year. Your 20 is now 10. But with a stock option, if it goes up 100 in that same year, your option has an embedded spread of 20. Comes back down 50%, your option now is worthless. So there is a key economic difference between deferred comp and an option, but nonetheless, it could still be a compelling thing to think about because it does, if it's effective, it does give you a lot of control as to when you receive compensation and ultimately when it's taxable. There are obviously a lot of other complexities associated with the program, one of which is whether or not the IRS, when they wrote in the notice that came out earlier interpreting 457A, if they really had in mind when they were talking about stock options, entities that don't trade above net book value. Typically what they're thinking about is true operating organizations where it's a normal part of the compensatory practice to compensate executives with stock options. And it's hard to envision, although you could logically get there from the statute and from the one notice that's out there, that these that this is what Congress and this is what the IRS really had in mind. I mean, in many ways, you could argue it seems somewhat abusive. But nonetheless, there's definitely folks in this room who have been or will be approached with implementing such a program, and it's something that we generally need to consider and consider it very carefully. I mean, there's a number of other tax issues associated with this program, a lot of PFIC issues, which I'm not capable of talking about. But it's one of those things when you hear about it, it sounds almost like it's too good to be true. And I guess our general concern is it maybe or it may not be, but it's something that you need to go into with your eyes wide open.
And this is not just an issue related to receiving an investment from Utah or CalPERS. If this takes off, I mean, it would revolutionize the tax compensation system for hedge funds and also could even apply with tweaks potentially to private equity. In the private equity world, managers earn carried interest, GPs earn carried interest, and they receive tax distributions, which dilutes the earnings of the fund and takes cash out of the system. So it's very interesting. The IRS does know about this. There are enough law firms that were offended by the result, and most of the law firms who've been looking at this, the predominant hedge fund and private equity firms, do not like this. They think it's an aggressive approach that gets around the purposes of Section 457 Cap A. That said, there's a lot of technical merit to parts of it, and there's different levels of risk and complexity. as Bruce was mentioning, an option program that just satisfied the Utah pension fund's need to align their interest with the manager is probably a lot less risky than a 20-year deferral program where the manager could take the money out anytime after 3 years and controls the risk level of the asset pool. So, you know, it's something that everybody should consider carefully. It'll be interesting to see how it ends up. I think ultimately the IRS will come out with regulations to prohibit it. There's an analogous situation for tax exempt for certain types of deferred compensation for tax exempt entities like hospitals, where they've went through an issue like this years ago, and the IRS regulated and the Congress legislated against this type of approach. But we'll see what happens.
We've seen an increasing use of hurdles as an ingredient in the performance formula. In some cases, they're based on money market or interest-type rates of return. In some cases, they are tied to an index, I think suggesting an increasing unwillingness on the part of alternative investment fund investors to pay for beta. And so in some cases, you can have the phenomenon of a fund manager beating the hurdle and being eligible for performance compensation, even though the absolute return is negative. Stuart, do you want to comment on some of the issues that can raise in a traditional hedge fund structure?
Yeah, it's to structure a compensation arrangement where a manager is being paid even though the performance is negative because they beat a benchmark is very challenging to structure as a carried interest. There are some theories where you might be able to take the position that if the fund is actually up and beats the benchmark, that what you have is an allocation of profits that's treated like a carry, and if it's down and you get paid, it's a guaranteed payment, which would have all sorts of impacts on both the manager. It would be treated as ordinary income and would not reflect the underlying character of the fund, fund's realizations, and could affect the investors, since guaranteed payments could be treated as miscellaneous itemized deductions, and rather than allocations, which are generally preferable for U.S. taxable individual investors in a fund. So there are, beyond the scope of this panel, there are ideas and approaches to deal with this. It depends on the investment program, on whether you can kind of slice and dice investments into multiple fund entities to create effectively profit pools that are treated as carried interest. It's a very challenging issue, especially in light of Section 457 Cap A, which means you just can't say, I'll treat this as a fee, you know, and pay it 3 years later based on, you know, beating a benchmark. So I don't know if, Bruce, you had any insight on that, but it's, Steve, it's a pretty challenging fee structuring exercise.
Alex, you mentioned in your opening remarks that one of the things that has come out of the crisis in terms of how investors look at investments is not just looking at the manager, but looking sideways at their co-investors. And we certainly saw that as well. We saw investors who had a longer view become increasingly impatient with the notion that investors who were in a hurry to get their money out could do permanent damage to the portfolio. There was a lot of talk about how that was going to lead to separate accounts as the replacement of hedge funds. What have you seen in terms of that actually happening?
Yeah, no, we've seen, it's funny. We've seen a lot of interest in separate accounts, certainly. There are some fund of funds platforms that are morphing themselves into, you know, all separate accounts kind of platforms. We see a number of institutional investors coming in and with, you know, exchange for large amounts of capital asking for separate accounts. But we're still seeing a tremendous amount of pushback by managers on separate accounts. And it becomes very complex to the extent you have a strategy which is, you know, complex in its nature with a lot of, you know, derivative type of exposures, to have a number of these separate accounts becomes really burdensome from an operational perspective to have. So we've seen a lot of pushback, and again, it's a negotiation, and the larger managers, especially, just aren't willing to take it. It probably works best with what we've seen, the younger or smaller managers. That said, there are a good number. There's a few, corporate pension funds like a Lockheed, for example, who just really sticks to their guns on wanting a separate account. And it's going to be interesting because, in many cases, investors like that maybe are missing out on some of the better managers out there, many of whom will not do separate accounts, certainly at a certain stage in their evolution. So not seeing a lot of activity, seeing a lot of interest.
Yeah, that's consistent with what we've seen. Some of the well-known managed account platforms, I think, have become more active. But we've seen other institutional investors who think they want managed accounts until they get told
exactly
what they need in order to be equipped to handle it, and then they've retreated. Although in some cases we've seen investors and managers agree on using a single investor fund structure, which achieves, frankly, many of the benefits that the investor is seeking, particularly to insulate the investor from the consequences of redemption by other investors, and at the same time not forcing the investor to have to put together all of the infrastructure that's required to operate its own separate account.
And that's consistent with what we're seeing, too. But there's a limitation to how much of that hedge fund managers want to do. And, that's okay if you have a few of them, but if you have beyond a handful, it becomes just from an administrative perspective burdensome for them. So depends on the underlying strategy, how complicated it is.
Yeah. We're running short on time. Let's, as our last topic, talk for a minute about gates. As I mentioned at the outset, it used to be thought that gates were never meant to be used. They were used quite regularly over the past year and a half. Alex, what are you seeing in new funds? Are there gates of different flavors or no gates? What's happening?
Again, it depends on the underlying strategy. If it's something in the credit space, something where a strategy where you need a stable capital base for an extended period of time, sure, gates are demanded basically by investors. Of course, it's beneficial to the manager, and those gates tend to be investor-level gates rather than fund-level gates. Again, that's being driven by the investors because they want to, as they look, as you said before, side by side as to who's next to them, they want to make sure they have that stable capital base. So, gates are something that's commonly accepted now and viewed as a benefit, and investors are happy to see them implemented if need be.